Welcome to OnkLive On Air. I'm your host today, Ashlyn Wehner. OnkLive On Air is a podcast from OnkLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, OnkLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Bristol-Myers Squibb, Guillermo Garcia Manero, MD, and Amer Zeidan, MBBS, MHS, discussed important elements of the Phase 3 COMMANDS trial in lower-risk myelodysplastic syndromes. Garcia Manero is a professor in the Department of Leukemia, chief of the Section of Myelodysplastic Syndromes, deputy chair of translational research, and fellowship program director in the Division of Cancer Medicine at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. Zeidan is an associate professor of internal medicine, hematology, at Yale School of Medicine, director of early therapeutics research in hematology, leader of the clinical research team for leukemias and myeloid malignancies, and interim chief of hematologic malignancies at Yale Cancer Center in New Haven, Connecticut. In our exclusive interview, Drs. Garcia Manero and Zeidan discussed the significance of efficacy and safety data from the COMMANDS trial in MDS, takeaways from the subgroup analyses, and expectations around treatment sequencing in the lower-risk population.
Hello, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Guillermo Garcia Manero from the Department of Leukemia at MD Anderson Cancer Center. And today I'm with my colleague, Dr. Amer Zeidan. Amer?
Yeah, hi, everyone. Hi, Guillermo. My name is Amer Zeidan. I'm an associate professor of medicine at Yale University, and a pleasure to be here today.
So today we're going to be discussing the results of the COMMANDS trial that were presented at ASCO and EHA 2023 and recently published in The Lancet. So the first question that I'm going to address, and we'll be alternating these questions with Dr. Zeidan, are can we detail the design and objectives of the COMMANDS trial? So the COMMANDS trial was a very, in my opinion, ambitious study looking at the role of a drug known as luspatercept that is already actually approved for a subtype of patients with MDS, non-enriched sideroblastic anemia, in second line for those patients that were not candidates or had not benefited from an erythroid stimulating agent. The data from that study was known as the MEDALIST trial, suggested that the drug had activity, was safe, and also we saw an effect in terms of those patients with a lower transfusion burden perhaps having more benefit from the intervention. So it was logical to move this to the front line. And indeed, that's what the COMMANDS trial is. So this is a study for patients with low-risk MDS defined by IPSSR criteria that were transfusion-dependent of red cells, so anemic, very well-defined boundaries in terms of these transfusions. And then the patients were randomized between luspatercept, that was the investigational agent here, versus a standard of care that was selected as epoetin alpha. This was a one-to-one randomization. The study accrued any type of low-risk MDS, so there was no like phenotype or genotype specific to the study. And in my opinion, had a very important primary endpoint that was basically increase in response. And the response, I think, was actually very well designed in the sense that it was not only transfusion independency for 12 weeks during a 24-week period, but also an increment in hemoglobin levels of around 1.5 grams. So basically, for a patient to be quote-unquote responder, you have to have that dual endpoint of transfusion dependency plus the increase in the hemoglobin levels. There were other secondary endpoints, but the primary endpoint was basically the response rate. So the next question that we're going to ask to Dr. Zeidan is as follows. So Amer, can you please walk us through the data from the trial, both in terms of safety and efficacy?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, Guillermo, this was a very well-conducted study and very well-designed study, in my opinion as well. And I think the primary endpoint, which you described very well, is a combination of transfusion independence and a hemoglobin increase of 1.5 grams per deciliter over a 12-week period. So it's longer than the traditional endpoint that was used in other trials, which is 8-week transfusion independence. And this was actually met with a significantly higher rate of transfusion independence of around 60%. So I believe the actual number is 58% compared to 30%. So almost double the rate of transfusion independence with luspatercept compared to ESA as a frontline treatment. In terms of other endpoints aside from the primary endpoint, I think the durability of the response was quite interesting. The median was 2.5 years with luspatercept, and this is much longer, especially when you think about the activity of luspatercept in the second line where the median duration independence of the longest episode was around 38 weeks, I believe, or 37 weeks. In terms of the other endpoints for safety, this drug is actually one of the easiest drugs to give in our practice. We did not discover any new signals that are concerning within the context of this drug that has been already in clinical use for a couple of years. The most common side effects are fatigue that tends to burn out within the first couple of cycles. So it's very uncommon to discontinue patients because of it. Other things that, such as myalgias or some fluctuations in the counts, those are not common. So it's a pretty safe drug. I think the efficacy based on the rate of transfusion independence as well as the durability was remarkable. And I direct this next question to you, Guillermo, because I think subgroup analysis of this study has also yielded important observations. So maybe you can walk us through those.
Thank you, Amer. So the study enrolled 178 patients on each arm, I believe. In general, the characteristics in terms of risk, cytopenias, et cetera, were very well balanced. But there was actually less patients with non-ring sideroblastic anemia enrolled on the trial. And this is going to be important for the discussion. So around 70% or so of the patients were RS positive and the rest were RS negative. This was not pre-planned. Actually, the analysis that Dr. Seydan just mentioned in terms of the efficacy and the duration of response, and I totally agree with his assessment that doubling the response, doubling actually potentially the duration of response is quite significant. But here, you know, this was not a plan, like we were going to have more or less RS positive for any particular subset. So the analysis that Dr. Seydan just mentioned is what we call the intent to treat analysis. And I believe that this data should be taken as such because the study is really not designed to really look at any different subgroup in terms of making a decision. And indeed, actually, that's how the FDA viewed this data. And that's why, you know, we will discuss the label later that is quite broad and reflective of the results of the study. Now, going back to the granularity of this question, what we saw is that when we broke these patients by different subsets that in general were RS positive disease, RS negative disease, different thresholds of erythropoietin levels, and the status of the SF3B1 mutation, in general, all of them were in favor of the luspatercept arm. So for instance, patients that were RS positive, they had dramatic responses compared to those that were RS negative. Those patients that had a higher or lower EPO level, let's say 200, were always also in favor of the luspatercept. I should say, though, that this is important, and I failed to mention that in the first question, that is, the study was capped for an EPO level of 500, and some people have asked why. And the reality is, I think was the first thing to do, right? Because if you had not restricted those patients with that EPO level, then you could have accrued patients that were not candidate for an ESA. You know, we know that an ESA does not really work very well over this level of 500 in terms of the EPO level. So we actually tried to be fair to the control arm by restricting the upper boundary of the EPO level. So I hope that that clarifies this question. So bottom line is that we saw responses in any EPO level in favor of the luspatercept. Importantly, actually, those patients that were SF3B1 mutated or not were also in favor of the luspatercept. But when it came to the fact of the phenotype of the disease, meaning those that were RS negative, there, actually, we did not see an improvement in response as opposed to comparing luspatercept versus the ESA. Now, I should say that when you look at the duration of response on the RS negative subgroup, although it's a smaller fraction of patients, it's actually in favor of the luspatercept. So the response rate actually is not dissimilar between RS positive and RS negative, but in the analysis presented from the command trial, the duration of response is longer. But this has opened a debate in the community in terms of what will be, based on this data, the role of luspatercept in RS negative disease. And I think actually maybe this could be the question that then Dr. Seydan could address next in terms of how the COMMANDS data has changed the landscape in the treatment of low-risk MDS. Overall, all the subgroups analysis suggested that luspatercept was superior to an ESA, except for the subgroup of patients that were RS negative, where the response rate was equivalent, although with a longer rate duration of response. Amer?
Yeah, thank you, Guillermo. This was an excellent summary. And I do think the very good results from the trial, as well as wide approval by the FDA, is going to open the door for a significant change in the landscape of management of lower risk MDS patients in general, because we know anemia is the primary issue that most patients with lower risk MDS kind of suffer from. And for a long time, ESAs have been the primary or the frontline treatment, although ESAs have not been approved for MDS. This is very interesting that they have never been approved formally, although they are certainly effective, but they are mostly effective, as Guillermo mentioned, in patients who have low EPO level and patients who are not needing very frequent transfusions. So I think when you think about patients with lower risk MDS in the frontline treatment, we have clear evidence, I think, right now that luspatercept is better in the RS positive patients. My expectation is that the vast majority of those patients, at least in the US, where the approval by the FDA has happened, will probably be starting to go on luspatercept as a first-line treatment. There might be issues related to insurance and formulary on certain places and some other reasons why some people might not use it. I think another open question is going to be, what is the activity of ESA after luspatercept? I think this is an important aspect to kind of think about, because in theory, you don't want to be burning bridges by if ESA somehow does not work after luspatercept, although I don't think there is any clinical reason to think that would be the case. I think for second line, this is also very interesting because currently luspatercept is probably the most common second line treatment after ESA that we currently use, because the side effect profile is pretty good. And I think many of us prefer to use it ahead of lenalidomide and Nandil-5Q and ahead of HMAs in patients who have anemia as a main problem. So I think if luspatercept moves to the first line, in especially in RS positive patients, I think this opens the door on what to do in the second line. And my expectation is that lenalidomide and HMAs will probably move there. ESA, I think many people still will probably use them after luspatercept, although again, we still need some additional data. And of course, we have another drug we are not going to discuss in detail today, is imetelstat, which has been also shown to be very active in the second line setting. So potentially, this is also in front of the FDA. So that potentially, if approved in 2024, could also potentially fit there. But maybe I can take the next question to you, Guillermo. And, you know, both you and I were very involved in that trial, and kind of seeing the results basically was still somewhat, I would say, surprising to me in terms of how good the outcome was. But did anything in particular surprise you once you have heard the results initially, but also once you have seen the full set of data?
Well, as you mentioned, you know, because we have done so many trials in this disease that start with very promising phase one and then promising phase twos, and then we move to the phase three, and all of a sudden, I think this has some name, this phenomenon is well understood, some type of regression, where all of a sudden these great responses disappear and then you don't get an approval. Of course, we have seen that in multiple doublets in high-risk myelodysplastic syndrome. And we have worked so hard to really get a drug approved. So I think my surprise is that in general, you know, we're moving the field very fast in low-risk MDS. So that's actually extremely positive, because majority of the patients with this disease actually will present in this subset. So yes, I was surprised by the magnitude of the results, because, you know, we saw the Medalist trial in a very difficult to treat population, and then we got an approval there, right? But the response rate was around 30-something%. The duration was relatively short, was much better than placebo for a group of patients where there is no true indication. But it was difficult for me to extrapolate how this was going to look at front. I had a feeling that moving this drug earlier was going to be more effective. But the study was extremely well conducted in terms of the guidelines for transfusions, guidelines for dose escalation of the luspatercept, guidelines for dose escalation of the ESA. And in addition, because the toxicity profile was not very different from the investigational agent and the control agent, I had no way to know whether the patient was on control or on the investigational drug. So that's actually very important, because I think we were totally blinded here. And, you know, the study, of course, was a blinded trial, but if you have conducted the studies, you know, sometimes there's some toxicity profile that may give you an idea of what the patient is receiving. Here, this was very hard to know. So actually, I had no true expectation. You know, if they had been neutral, this would be another study in MDS that after phase one, two, even prior phase three data goes to be negative up front. So yes, I was surprised by the magnitude of the results. You know, Amer said doubling of the response rate. Actually, that's important to me, but I think what is very important is actually the duration of those responses. It's actually, if you look at the numbers, almost a year longer than what you see with the control. That is going to be very important for our patients. So I was very positively surprise. And I think this actually is not an error or an artifact or some stochastic issue. I think that the field is moving in terms of earlier treatment of this disease. I guess we're going to be discussing the label where actually transfusion dependency is not really mandated. And we can discuss why this could be quite important. But we're seeing data from lenalidomide in TI in transfusion-dependent DEL5Q MDS. We see actually the early data with growth factors by the Nordic group 15 years ago, pointing actually that maybe this is the right situation. And I think what's going to be interesting from this next generation of studies is what is the impact in the natural history of the disease. Like if these patients start having robust responses up front that they last for a long period of time, could this be changing their natural history? And then Amer opened a very important concept that is the sequence of these therapies, right? Because hopefully we'll have another approval next year. We have lenalidomide hypomethylating agents, the oral hypomethylating agents. There's actually a list of like maybe 6 or 7 drugs that are in advanced phase 1 trials moving in this particular context. So it's going to be very important for us to understand the sequence, you know, as he says, do we know what ESA does after Luspa? Do we know what luspatercept does after an ESA in the RS negative context? We don't know that. So I think this is going to open the doors for a lot of research, but this is maybe for academic centers to think. I think moving forward, this is going to be a drug that is going to be very important in the community setting, that is the front line for majority of the patients with low risk MDS with anemia.
Yeah, thank you, Guillermo. So I think the next question we were going to talk about is the significance, which we covered, I think, quite well. As you know, I don't think there is much can be more significant than changing the frontline treatment of any particular disorder. But regarding the FDA label, which you touched on this a little bit, this was actually another pleasant surprise in the context of this drug guy. You know, and historically, I think the FDA has been very restrictive, I would say, on MDS in particular in terms of approvals and the scope of approvals. And we were thinking a lot about, you know, how is the issue that Dr. Garcia Manero discussed in detail regarding the RS negative. I feel the same way like him that this subgroup analysis, you know, that was unplanned, you know, this would not be used to approve a drug. So certainly should not be used against a drug to say that it does not work in that settings. But I think what was particularly interesting to me is the label regarding the red blood cell transfusion. As Dr. Garcia Manier mentioned, you know, the label says in patients who may need red blood cell transfusion. So I think that opens it up for interpretation whether the patient has to require transfusions, which historically has been the way that all drugs have been kind of recommended in the guidelines and or in practice is in patients who are already needing transfusions. But we have patients who are symptomatic and really refuse transfusions. They don't want transfusions. They are not low enough to a degree where we typically use transfusions. And I think this also links in to probably future development. I think we'll probably focus on two aspects. One is how do you improve upon this with combinations? And then moving this earlier, as Dr. Garcia Manero mentioned, in terms of taking it to the next step and maybe treating patients early in their courses formally. And there is a planned trial called the Element, which will look at patients who are not transfusion dependent using a similar design, somewhat similar to the COMMANDS trial, but the patients will not be transfusion dependent. And I think this also along the line of the lenalidomide data that also looked at patients deletion 5Q in the CENREP study on patients who are not needing also transfusions and the potential for changing the natural history of the disease. And I think the last aspect I think is important to emphasize is that most of our therapies have historically been focused on improving the anemia, not at resolving the anemia. And I always wonder, like, why do we have to aim just for a hemoglobin of 11 when we know that this is still anemia? Why can't we get to a hemoglobin of 13, which is complete resolution of anemia? In the past, we did not have great drugs. Now we have good drugs. We could aim higher and try to help our patients because we know anemia has a lot of negative physiologic long-term consequences. So I think this is an important aspect to kind of think about. Guillermo, as you think about all these new agents, and you know, do you think we are reaching to a point where we are somewhat similar to the multiple myeloma space, where especially in the lower risk, as you said, we had a lot of failures, unfortunately, in the high-risk disease, but we have a number of agents that are active and approved now in lower risk disease and a number of other ones that are in advanced development. So how do you see the next steps for development in the lower risk space, in particular for combinations and sequencing kind of endpoints? I think it's going to get a bit trickier to design these trials.
If you allow me to clarify a little bit this question of the transfusion dependency or not based on the FDA label, I think, unfortunately, we live in the post-COVID time. And I think that really has affected us very much. In addition, we have not discussed the cost of transfusions. MD Anderson has invested quite a bit, for instance, in a transfusion unit that is incredible. And I'm sure the same thing at your center at Yale. So, you know, people don't think about this, but there is toxicity from transfusions. There is a cost from monitoring these transfusions. Actually, there is significant oversight from CMS, etc., and the local and federal government in terms of toxicities associated with this transfusion. So this is not trivial. And I think we need to see further pharmacoeconomic data in terms of actually these issues that you were mentioning earlier, cost, etc. But what we're seeing in my practice routinely, for instance, as an example to community, will be individual that comes to see you with newly diagnosed disease, 7.5 grams of hemoglobin, not feeling very well, but for whatever reason, in their local center or even sometimes at MD Anderson, depending on whether we're good or not with donors, you cannot transfuse that patient. So then, technically, this is a transfusion-independent patient. But of course, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, you would be transfusing this patient automatically, right? So I think that's where the FDA is perhaps seeing this, that there is a pool of patients where we are not as good transfusing as we were, or liberal. I don't know, good is bad. You know, the reality is that we have changed our threshold for transfusions, many centers doing 7 grams of hemoglobin. We have maybe a smaller pool of donors or... So I think there are a number of things that happened around the COVID time that made this transfusion process more complex. And I think that's where maybe the FDA erred. I don't know, I was not part of this process, but I think we have to have respect to the authorities here because that is a very important group of patients. And why would you not start this kind of therapies, even if the patient is not technically transfusion dependent? Of course, it's very easy to go and say, let's give him one unit or her and, you know, bypass this. That maybe is not common sense. In terms of the 13 grams of hemoglobin, yeah, I think this is a safety issue. I trained under Dr. Erslev that discovered erythropoietin many years ago. He died around 20 years ago. But in the early days of the ESAs, some people died from, you know, driving hemoglobins to 16, 17 grams of hemoglobin, these kind of things. So I think the authorities have always been kind of cautious with these kind of issues. Now we start giving these drugs. We don't really monitor this well. Patient has 20 grams hemoglobin. You know, that was going to happen. And then you have a major cardiovascular event. I think that is probably very uncommon. And I think you're totally right there that perhaps we should think about, you know, should we try to even move this to a higher threshold? I don't know if you remember this data, but a number of years ago, there was French data with this concept of hypertransfusion of red cells, where they will really push levels really high. And what they found actually is that the trough, the duration of the responses actually lasted longer. So in effect, you gave less blood, but that is not something that actually blood banks can accommodate. I think your question now next is very important. I don't think we're in the myeloma space yet because I don't think that we have multiple parallel drugs for frontline. I think this data gives you a substitute for an ESA. But I don't know that I will be putting an HMA in this group of patients. Like, actually, we have done that traditionally. And the compound that you mentioned earlier, imetelstat, has cytopenias that I think also are going to be tricky to incorporate upfront in this group of patients. Now, maybe if they invite that next year and some of these other drugs, or a couple of years or whatever, 3 or 4 of these other drugs come and they show a lot of activity, I think we're going to get there, actually. I think we're going to have you and I a podcast in a couple of years from now. We'll start showing, okay, we're moving those drugs alone. I think my take on this is for the community where the majority of this happens, you have a drug that I think is easier to use, similar safety profile, and with this kind of caveat of the RS negative, that overall is superior to an ESA. And again, as you very well mentioned, ESAs were never really formally studied in this patient population. Indeed, actually, the COMMANDS trial was the first study prospectively in the United States looking at an ESA. I think we should embrace this, but you're totally right. 60% maybe is not enough. We should move to like 100%, or maybe we should move to 13 grams of hemoglobin. And there the question is that through the ELEMENTS trial you mentioned? Is this through combination studies? We don't really understand 100% how this drug works, like probably none of the other drugs, but I think there's an opportunity for rational combinations. And then I really like your idea of, should we think about pushing this? Will the FDA allow to some safety design where maybe we don't cap this at 11 grams or 10 grams? I think that's really important. And indeed, I believe that there are a number of trials. You mentioned the ELEMENT trial. I believe there are CCUS studies that are either through the sponsor or by different investigators in the United States and Europe. There are goals for combination studies with ESAs. I think you're going to be leading one of those. So I think these are very exciting times for low-risk MDS. I think the take-home message is that these are very good times. We should see this data with its value. It is perfect? Probably not, but it's really good data. And it's actually, in reality, in my opinion, after development of lenalidomide, the cytarabine, esacitabine, 15, 20 years ago, is the first time in 15 years that we see a positive phase 3 trial where we double response, where we have a significant impact on duration. Let's embrace this. It's a safe drug. Let's learn how to make this better. And as Dr. Seydan says, now this opens the door to all these questions, sequence, combinations, thresholds. Very exciting for us, very good for our patients, and very good for the community physicians that treat a majority of these patients. Amer?
Yeah, thank you so much, Dr. Garcia Manero. Very nice summary. I think we align on, I think, most of these aspects. And I'm sure, like me, you're hoping that we can see some success in the high-risk MDS space, which has been, unfortunately, very disheartening to many of us who have been around, you know, in this space. But it's certainly a very exciting year for lower-risk MDS. I think it has been formally. We did not discuss the classification issue, which nobody likes to discuss anymore. But, you know, I think everybody understands that these are cancers. These are neoplasms. They limit patient survival. You have to take them seriously. You have to treat the patients. You have to look for the best treatment, not just give them ESA or transfusions and just forget kind of about them. So I do think we are entering a new phase in the management of MDS, and hopefully therapies for high-risk MDS will continue in that direction.
I think you really summarized it extremely well, but you brought a point that maybe you should have discussed at the beginning that is crucial. That is, you know, traditionally when we write these papers, we say, oh, high-risk disease, we need to try to cure it. Low-risk disease, let's just try to mitigate symptoms, etc. But that's maybe the wrong paradigm. Maybe the right paradigm is maybe our opportunity to arrest the evolution of the disease, maybe to have an impact on survival is what we're talking about here with the commands. Why? Because there is data that I never understood. For instance, that the transfusion burden is associated with lower survival. Of course, we know the end tissue damage that maybe iron deposition can cause on these patients, etc. And now you have drugs that may stop this or may really have an impact on this process, and it could eventually transform into less complications from iron deposition, the chronic transfusions. We have not touched on the comorbidity issues that we see that we think are part of the disease that could somehow mitigated by this kind of intervention. And I'm not just claiming this is only for luspatercept, but as we move more drugs up front, as you were mentioning, I think that that's going to be very interesting. And perhaps we should start thinking about curing low-risk myelodysplastic syndrome or really prolonging the survival of our patients. I think that's what maybe we need to start being more aggressive and not just saying we want to improve symptoms or maybe we just want to decrease transfusion burden a little bit. Now that we're starting to have these tools, perhaps we can be a little bit more ambitious for the sake of our patients.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by Bristol-Myers Squibb. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.